It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
There are so many stories around food and agriculture, and I find people that are on journeys, and my next guest is one of those that's on a journey. Not a journey alone. She's on a journey with her husband and her daughter, and it's taking her from one continent to another and back and here and from jobs in Texas to working on a farm, and it's an interesting journey. I want to welcome Melissa Phillips.
Hello.
So, Melissa, so you grew up in the UK. Did I get that right?
You did. Yes. I grew up in London, and I was there from 9 years old to when I went off to university in the north of England.
And when you went to the north of England, what did you study there?
Sociology.
Ah, I did sociology too.
Oh, there you
Ended
go.
Up doing agriculture. So that
no,
was.
It's not and, such an and abnormal
then
journey.
From that, you, somewhere along the way, you got married, mm-hmm. and you and your husband lived in the UK for a while before you left?
We did as boyfriend and girlfriend, mm-hmm. and we left for Austin, Texas. His job moved us there, and we got married about 3 or 4 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And we had enough of the Texas lifestyle by that point, or around that point, and decided to pack it all in. We sold lots of our belongings and bought an old Chevy Trans van for some crazy reason, and went off in search of a life that we both felt was more fulfilling. And we found ourselves, after a roundabout journey, on the Kern family farm in North Fork.
Where is North Fork? How do you get to there?
Well, we went many thousands of miles out of our way, but if you were to go there directly, you'd travel to the exact center of California, perhaps via LA or San Francisco. Its nearest big town is Fresno, big city is Fresno, and it's south of Yosemite.
Ah, so it's beautiful country up there in the mountains.
Yeah, it's the Sierra Mountains. We're nestled in the Sierra National Forest.
So, well, first of all, you're starting the journey that a lot of people envy, that of saying that you want to do something different. I mean, a lot of people would like to end up in Austin. They, you know, Austin's a great city, and they're pretty progressive on many different things, and they've got quite a farm-to-food kind of movement around that area.
Absolutely.
As well. And yet, you were saying this isn't it, and you guys are going to pull up stakes, and you get, I can't remember, was it a truck or a van that you
van. Yeah, and I should reiterate that we lived in Austin and San Antonio, and a lot of my inspiration in buying locally, knowing my farmers, growing my own food, it's kind of started there. So I have Texas to thank for that, for sure. And then, of course, my master's in sustainability really opened my eyes to the problems within the food system and kind of switched me on to everything from pesticides to GM to social injustice surrounding farmers, and yeah, started a long journey.
Did you have a baby then when you left, or was it still ahead of you?
We had her just before we left. So when we left, she was about 6 or 7 months old.
Ah, then you're even more brave than I thought. So you
brave
actually
or crazy?
Have,
I know. Yes,
many would say that. I don't. I think it's brave. So you start off with you leave jobs, you leave a place you had established, you have a baby, you get in the van, and you start driving. Almost everything is north from there. So I suppose you just started heading north. Where did you circle? Where did you drive when you were kind of looking around?
Gosh, we headed out the west of Texas into New Mexico and up through Albuquerque and visited friends in Colorado and some national parks along the way. We went to Arches and Zion and obviously Joshua Tree and Yosemite. And learned how to live in a van with a baby and a dog. I shouldn't forget.
Oh, you had the dog,
our
too.
Dog, obviously.
So you weren't checking into the hotel every night?
No, we started out in sort of state parks, national parks, the odd RV park when we got really desperate and decided never to do that again. And now we're a bit more savvy about finding public lands and BLM and try to not pay every night when we're on our adventures.
So when did it occur to you that you should try to get onto an organic farm? And that might be the next place to land for a while.
So we didn't just leave jobs. A job ended very suddenly in San Antonio, and it forced us to really reevaluate what direction we'd been heading in. And it was one that neither of us kind of had imagined ourselves.
Yeah.
And we both had this interest and passion in growing our own food. We had a plot at a community garden, and we had a pipe dream of perhaps owning our own farm one day, but neither of us had any farm experience, so it was kind of a weird thing for us both to be thinking about. And so it just seemed like the perfect time to go and gain experience, and we'd heard of the Woofing program,
Worldwide Organization for Organic Farming.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Yes. And we got in touch with many farms up the West Coast, and the Kearns were the only people who got back to us and said, sure, bring the baby, bring the dog. And
so you got a couple, a baby, a dog in a van, and you head to the mountains.
Yeah, and it was it seemed nerve-wracking and risky until we arrived and we met the Kearns, and after a few weeks of settling in and working, you kind of work for your board and keep, it just felt like the exact right place to be, and it's felt like that ever since. So we keep extending our time there and taking on more responsibilities and really becoming, we feel like, members of the family almost and of the farm.
So do they have a house or an apartment, or what do you live
in? They've built everything on the farm, and it's all off-grid, and we have a fabulous little cottage on some bluffs overlooking the San Joaquin Valley. It's truly magical. And there's a communal village as well where we started out there with all the other woofers. So we all shared living space and cooking space and everything. And then when we established a kind of long-term relationship, we moved to our own little private family quarters, which was quite nice, having a baby and some a little bit of privacy. And now we kind of work together and are involved in the farmers market and their store in town, and just they love having us and we love being there.
That's right. Now, I got to ask about like daycare and type stuff. I mean, are you able to take the baby out to the fields, or how do you do that?
She works with us.
How old is she?
She's 16 months.
Oh, that's great. Get them started young.
Yeah, she's just about pulling her weight. But no, it started out that we would wear her in little baby carriers.
Sure.
And now she's toddling around and playing in puddles and eating dirt and playing with the dogs and kind of amuses herself. She was the main reason we thought it would all be possible.
This is going to be a healthy kid.
Yeah, she's super healthy and is outdoors 90% of the time and eats vegetables straight out of the ground.
Now, so what's a day like? I mean, are you at different times of year? I know the crops are different stages of work, but what are the crops you're working with, and what do you do with the crops when you do your work?
Everything. So we plant, we prepare fields and greenhouses. The farm's on about 3 to 4 acres, though the property itself is about 80 acres. We harvest, we prepare the vegetables and fruit for market and for the store. There's various building projects going on all the time. The farmers have a list as long as their arm of to-dos, so especially in the winter months, we're trying to get ahead of the game. And we have plans to build a new greenhouse, to build a new communal area. There's also managing the surrounding land and getting firewood and milking the goats. And there's just, they have bees.
So you do all of that?
Yeah, you can be involved in as much as you want. The more you put in, the more you get out. We're expected to work 4 hours a day, mm-hmm. Monday through Thursday, for board and keep. And then pretty much everyone gets involved in the afternoon as well. So we'll have our own projects going on, from washing eggs to preserving tomatoes to weeding and gosh, there's so much going on all the time.
Now, have you gone to the farmers markets with the products too?
Yeah, my husband and I, Jack and I, managed the farmers market last year, and now we're going to be sticking around at least till September. We're going to manage it this year. And Jack's also been involved in, because his background was sales and marketing, he has been involved in getting more customers for the farm. So they were already supplying to a couple local restaurants, mm-hmm. And he's approached a few more restaurants, and people are really interested, and there's more restaurants opening who are interested in supporting local agriculture, which is really great.
That's great. Anything is, when you've been doing the farmers markets, what surprised you? Either questions that come up, or when you're getting that interface of, you do the work all week and then you're there at a farmer's market. Has anything surprised you that consumers have asked you about your farming practices or the food that you're producing?
Well, it's amazingly satisfying, kind of planting, growing, harvesting, and selling the produce each week, and seeing exactly who it's going to, and having long involved conversations about what customers are going to do with the produce, or how they're growing it, asking for advice. And we were just novices, so we kind of would learn a lot from the customers too. And I think people who go to farmers markets are so connected with seasonal growing that right. they know when tomatoes are going to be in season. Right. So you start getting those questions of, oh, are the tomatoes nearly ready yet? As opposed to, you know, do you have any zucchini in the middle of winter, right. or anything like that. So I haven't really been all that shocked by people. I've just been pleasantly surprised at how switched on they are, and hopefully more people kind of...
Now, the market that you're going to, what towns are you in?
Just in Oakhurst. Ah, so okay. That's at the southern gate of Yosemite, and it's just a summer market. Unfortunately, it would be nice if it was year-round, mm-hmm. and we are constantly toying with the idea of going into Fresno and kind of committing to something like that. And we've also got our store in town, so we'd like to direct more people to the fact, or show them that they have this amazing, amazing organic yeah. store in the middle of what is nearly a food desert.
Well, what a story. This is exciting. And, you know, from UK to Texas, and you find yourself in the mountains, and with your husband and the dog and your baby. But are you starting to decide what's the next stage for you? You don't have to share any other dreams necessarily, but how do you surely recognize this isn't something you can do forever. So are you starting to talk about what's next?
Yes, definitely. And that's kind of why we're here. We're here to figure out if this is the lifestyle for us. I know farming is hard. It can be a struggle, and undoubtedly there will be really kind of tough days. But the more we see of it, the more we realize it's exactly what we want to do. And being in this fight for food security is where I want to kind of focus our life's work. So we talk often about where we're going to do that, and it's a tough question when you could go anywhere. from Europe to the States. It's, yeah, we're just trying to figure out where we want to be and what we want to grow, how we want to grow it. I think permaculture is the only way forward for us. Mm-hmm. But we still have so much to learn, and that's kind of what we're...
Well, some of my listeners have something to learn, too. And one is, it comes up, is it kind of the definition of permaculture. So you're explaining to somebody, when you use that term permaculture, what does it mean?
Well, I'll steal a line that I literally just heard in a permaculture session at the EcoFarm conference. And it's the science of maximizing beneficial relationships.
Ah, it can apply long beyond your farm. Then.
Exactly. It can apply to your MO in life.
Yeah.
So, it's important to not only just find land and produce food on it, but actually to benefit the natural systems that are there long before you and long after you.
Ah, what a philosophy. Well, I'm glad you shared that, and I know you're going to do well. And it's exciting to hear about your journey and where you're heading and where the family's heading. And I know that all over the world there are opportunities now where people that are older farmers that are trying to help people get into the business.
Mm.
So there's more opportunities. You don't necessarily have to have a check to come and buy a farm to be able to get started farming.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be a great stage that you have in front of you. Mm. And just kind of wrapping up, I want to ask you again, if the farm you're involved with, do they have a website if people would like to check out the farm?
Absolutely. It's called Kern Family Farm, and that is the website. We also have a Facebook page, which is the Gnarly Carrot and Kern Family Farm. And the Gnarly Carrot's the store in town in North Fork.
How's that spelled?
G-N-A-R-L-Y.
Okay.
Carrot.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
And if anybody's in the Yosemite area, then I recommend stopping by for a smoothie or a fresh juice. We're about to start doing coffee and sandwiches as well.
Oh, that sounds...
And it's all beautiful, organic, locally sourced produce, and mainly from our farm.
Well, and the other thing we should plug again, too, is Wolfers. So they have a website. I think it's just Wolf. I don't know if it's Wolf.org or Wolf, but it's WOOF, and people could look it up if they're interested in themselves or people they know that might like to get into this kind of experience that got you started on this part of the journey.
Oh, absolutely. It's the most wonderful way to learn about farming. We all eat. So I think we all need to connect with how we grow our food and the struggles and successes of small local farms. Whether you're fresh out of college or you need a career break, it's just such an invigorating and inspirational way to spend some time in a local community.
And what's your daughter's name?
Phoenix Isabel.
Ah, great. Well, someday she's going to be able to look back and be glad that her mom, Melissa Phillips, her dad, Jack, helped her have this kind of experience growing up on a farm. And I want to thank you for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it immensely.
Melissa and her family are realizing their dream. Others are in the process of chasing their own dreams, or maybe they've gotten to that stage that they have realized the dream and they're starting to farm. And then they got a new dream. They like to extend the season. Well, my next guest is going to help us figure out how to do just that. My next guest is Andrew Mefford, and Andrew is the author of the Greenhouse and Hoop House Growers Handbook. And Andrew, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Yes, I'm the editor and publisher of Growing for Market magazine, which is a monthly, it's 10 times a year magazine for direct market growers.
So you did a presentation about greenhouse growing and hoop houses, and you've actually written a book about that. Is that right?
Yes, the Greenhouse and Hoop House Growers Handbook.
So to explain that to us, so for most people, they understand what a greenhouse is, but there's some of them that listen to the podcast don't know what a hoop is. So what's a hoop?
Yeah, sure. So we went to the trouble of saying both greenhouse and hoop house in the title of the book because most people, when they say greenhouse, they mean a heated structure. And so I wanted to make sure that people knew that the techniques in the book apply to an unheated structure, which we and a lot of people call a hoop house, to differentiate it from a greenhouse with heat.
So you start with the greenhouse. You can have a greenhouse without heat too, can you? From just having enough heat from solar that keeps it warm.
Well, I would still call that a hoop house, as a passive solar.
Okay.
Where you get all your heat from the sun.
So the main thing that I've heard you talk about already is to really extend the season. So there's much of the United States that has a relatively short growing season. So they're, like in your case, I think you mentioned that you get really great tomatoes for about a month. And when you were able to go inside, you could start having really great tomatoes as early as April. Did I get that right?
We would plant more like April or May, and then even so, that's how short our season is. Even in an unheated hoop house, we would not have tomatoes until more like June or July. So, but that's, you know, that's as the editor of a local foods magazine, that's why I'm so enthusiastic about greenhouses and hoop houses, because what to me what a greenhouse or hoop house does is it stretches out local food season, right? And almost the whole country is limited in some sense on season, right? I used to work on a farm out here in California, close to Chico. And even though they had what almost anybody else would consider a choice Mediterranean climate, they still put up hoop houses so they could plant tomatoes in March and have them in May. Yeah. So really, it's almost anywhere, wherever you are, people want everything year round, and you can stretch out the season even if you have a really nice climate to start with.
That's true, because even with berries here in California, we do a really great job with berry production. But the way that we're able to get it almost 365 days a year is go up and down the state. So they're in Watsonville, but then when it gets close to Christmas time, they're down around San Diego and in that area. Mm-hmm. So it does move up and down the state. Nobody gets really 12 months of perfect berries.
Right.
So now how much interest are you getting? I have a hard time phrasing this question, but I know there's a lot of interest in local food production. Where do you find the interest coming from? Are there certain regions of the country that are really showing the most interest in being able to go to greenhouses or hoops?
No, I would say it's something that applies, because it goes back to what we were just talking about, how really every region of the country is season limited in some way. You can't grow, say a tomato or a cucumber 12 months of the year in almost any part of the country except maybe Hawaii. And so growers in any part of the country are wanting to extend the season. And plus we've had the NRCS, so National Resource Conservation Service, has had a program for a number of years now where they are helping growers to put up hoop houses. And so that has created an influx of people who've never grown in a greenhouse or hoop house before, who all of a sudden have them. So we're getting a lot of interest in the book. Honestly, if I had to correlate it, we're getting a lot of more interest from the areas that have population centers.
Yeah.
Just because to have a direct market farm, you need an audience, essentially. You need a farmer's market, a CSA stand, someone you can wholesale to in your community. And so. That's why you'll find more hoop houses and greenhouses in actually closer to areas with a denser population, just because it makes more sense to grow the food closer to where the people are. So that's why there are probably fewer out on the high plains in California or
We got interrupted there because deer just ran by us.
Wow.
And into the woods. Well, what about like in big cities that have vacant lots? Because I know that there are many cities, Detroit's one that comes to mind right away, that has thousands of acres, it turns out, in the city limits that are abandoned factories, and you know they're getting to the soil again in those areas too. Are you seeing any of these hoops or greenhouses going up within large urban areas?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, I'm seeing a disproportionate interest from urban growers, because a lot of times urban growers only have a very small space. And one of the things I mentioned in my talk this morning is that greenhouse space is very precious real estate. And so if it, because it, 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 it's it requires more of an investment than say open farmland, but it also pays that investment back more quickly. It returns, it's more productive than open farmland. So for people who have say an open lot or even the top of a building, you may be aware there's a few projects in right. In New York City and in Chicago where they've put greenhouses up on the top of a building. So we're getting a lot of interest from both people growing in reclaimed areas of cities and on buildings and things like that, because if they only have a small area, the way for them to get the most out of a small area is to put up a greenhouse or a hoop house.
Now that brings up another area, and that is talking about soil itself, because in hoops you, and I suppose you could in greenhouses too, you aren't necessarily hydroponic. You might actually be in soil, or is it primarily in soil?
Well, I grow in soil. My book is, I like to say that my book is mostly about the ground up, because there's so much complexity to the fertility issues in a greenhouse. In fact, I've thought about possibly even doing a sequel on soil fertility, because a lot of the big greenhouse production these days is hydroponic, which is more it's more like a formula. You know, you get a water analysis and then you put this fertilizer in it and you do that. So the greenhouse and hoop house growing that I'm talking about is could apply to either. It's we're really talking about in my book. We're really talking about the top part of the plant, and the techniques could be applied to people growing hydroponically or in the soil
where the growth is taking place. With the kind of folks that are near large urban areas or in the urban areas, do those tend to be hydroponic or do they tend to be soil based?
I'm seeing a lot of both, because sometimes you brought up a good point earlier about the soil in urban areas. Some of the areas that are being reclaimed are kind of like brownfield sites. They may have had industrial production or may have industrial yeah. pollutants or things in the soil that you really wouldn't want to grow healthy food on. And so you could either grow flowers there that nobody's going to eat, or you could do production in pots or hydroponic or something like that. So I guess the idea is that the techniques in my book apply equally to either. In fact, a lot of the techniques that from my book I learned from really large hydroponic growers. And so I think the thing that makes my book interesting is that I tried their techniques as far as dealing with the plants out on my own farm, which is an in-soil certified organic and a lower tech situation. And so I think that's what really brings something new to the conversation, is that there are techniques from big greenhouses that work on the much smaller, low-tech situations.
Yeah. Well, and I've heard, too, that when you work in the cities, in some cases, they choose not to get to the soil because the soil had so much contamination, and they might even take asphalt or cement and take over a road or an area and then build beds on top of it and truck soil in and have raised beds on top of what was a hardscape.
Yeah, yeah. So to me, that's what's exciting about greenhouse growing, is that even if you have a really marginal climate or marginal soils, it gives you a way to grow something as close to people as possible. And so it gives people a way to grow in areas that otherwise wouldn't be suitable for agriculture.
So the people that are following your book and then are putting up hoops and so forth, and they're getting probably a lengthening their season of the products they have available, how are they marketing that? Are they drawing attention to that to the consumer, other than the fact you didn't expect to see my tomatoes for another month and here they are? Are you seeing them trying to explain to the consumers why they're able to give them this long season?
Well, yeah, and the book is really not about marketing, but of course I do cover marketing briefly, and then it's relevant to that kind of thing. And so I just my best advice for growers is just to think about what it is that makes their produce unique, and make sure and tout that on their marketing, whether it be that it's produced right here in your city, or is it organic, or is it just chemical free, or produced on a rooftop. Chances are people who are doing this kind of growing have a story, and so that's, they just need to figure out what it is about their story that makes it interesting.
So if they have a small farming operation already, or a big garden that wants to become a farm and they want to go to this next stage, is the entry point go to hoop houses first, and then you kind of figure out how to work within hoop houses and then go to greenhouses?
Yeah, that's Yes and no. You can go straight to a greenhouse, but it really I'd say it depends more on what people want to grow. If people really wanted to grow tomatoes in Alaska, I'd say they probably want to go ahead and put a heater in there. But most of the hoop houses can be retrofitted. So by hoop houses, once again, I mean unheated greenhouses. They can be retrofitted with a heater. So it's like most things. It's easier if you plan it to have a heater from the beginning. But one thing a lot of people do is put up a hoop house, that love it, realize the limitations of their hoop house, and then go stick a heater in it.
That's an important distinction that you're explaining, is that just adding the heater makes a difference. Because I just think of, when I think of the hoop house, I think of shaped like hoops, and that it has almost a solid covering or some sort of plastic over the top of it. And when I think of a greenhouse, I think of a more permanent structure or metal structure with glass panels or something that's making it. So I think of them as being two distinct different things, and you're explaining that the differentiation is largely whether there's heat or not.
Yeah, exactly, and that is a terminology that varies. Some people, and I had to just line that out in the book. And, you know, that's something I kind of define my terms in the book. You know, greenhouse, it means heat, and hoop house means unheated to me.
If you're just starting from scratch, you're a small farmer, you want to get into this. I mean, about how much does it cost to put up a unit? Is there any kind of ballpark figure that you say if you're going to put up a small unit to just give it a try, and to extend the season of what you're producing? How expensive is that?
Oh, that's really hard to say, just because there's, like everything, there are different options. But one way, there's something called a caterpillar tunnel, which is a very simple hoop house that where the plastic is held on by cords usually. And I think you can build, say, a 12 foot wide, 100 foot long caterpillar tunnel for about $1,000.
Wow.
And so that'll get you in the game. You know, that's the kind of thing I would think that you should be able to make the investment back on that within one season, and then you can decide if you like it and build a bigger structure. The distinction being a bigger structure is just going to cover more area and probably going to be more pleasant to work in too, just because you'll have a higher ceiling. Caterpillar tunnels, if you're tall, caterpillar tunnels can be painful on your forehead. But that would be a way that people could give it a shot before making a bigger investment.
And so you grow what? Leafy greens and vegetables, tomatoes, you know, fruit. What do you grow in them?
I have a very concrete recommendation actually for people of what they should try growing. So when I was working on farms, and then when I was in the seed industry and visiting with commercial greenhouses, I noticed that almost all the greenhouses were growing either a group of vining fruiting crops or leafy crops. And the vining fruiting group is tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, and eggplant. And the leafy group is lettuce, greens, microgreens, and herbs. Basil being the most notable herb there. And so those are the things that are just tried and true. They pay the bills. So I think my best piece of advice for someone who's starting out would be pick one or more of those eight crops. Those are the things that are most likely to pay back your investment and your time and your structure. If you get those down, you can do other stuff. But those are the things that, those eight crops are really the ones that pay the bills for greenhouses.
Well, I think that's interesting. And then you're able to get product into probably local stores and some restaurants that normally they don't have as local. And it's going to be interesting too, I think, for consumers, because they go to a store and if they see fresh tomatoes in Maine in June, they just assume they got shipped up from Florida or Mexico. And this is going to make them what? Pause and say, well, maybe not necessarily so.
Right. I know that at least our grocery store in Maine and a lot of the stores now, they know that people want local products, and they're willing to work with local growers to get their stuff in the stores, even if it's not 12 months of the year. They want to have that on their shelves, and so they'll work with local growers.
Well, you know, it's an exciting area that you're in, and for the people that are looking ways to extend their season, how do they find your book?
They can, well, it's wherever books are sold, on the Chelsea, it's published by Chelsea Green Publishing, so it's on their website, it's on the Growing for Market website, It's just growingformarket.com. So it's wherever books are sold. So
and Andrew Mefford, what's the name of the book again, though?
The name of the book is The Greenhouse and Hoop House Growers Handbook.
Yeah. Well, good luck. It sounds like an interesting adventure you're on. Thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.